This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
The world order is changing dramatically before our eyes. As America's influence in the world wanes, power is shifting to Asia. And Russia and China are the kings of the East, and they're working together more and more to reshape geopolitics. This week provided further evidence of this revolutionary trend, and for this, we go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was on Monday that Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping held a video conference. And at the end of it, they announced that they had officially extended the bilateral treaty of good neighborliness and friendly cooperation. So this is a treaty that was first established back in 2001. It was enacted by Putin, who had actually just become Russia's president a few months before that, and the Chinese leader Jiang Zemin. And it was a landmark treaty. It was really seen as a milestone because it fostered all kinds of close cooperation between the two nations. It really cleared the way for them to collaborate in a way that they never had before. And that was in July of 2001, and it was a 20-year treaty, so it would have expired this month. But now Putin and Xi have officially extended it for an undisclosed duration. And during the ceremony, when this extension was announced this week, we heard the two men spouting off a lot of the usual rhetoric that we've come to expect about how Russia-China relations are a positive force for the world, a lot about how they are injecting positive energy into the international community and that sort of thing. So I don't think that message is very convincing to many people outside of Russia and China. But nevertheless, the extension of this treaty does show that the Russia-China partnership is not a flash in the pan, and it's not as superficial as some Western analysts often portray it as being. It's actually becoming deeper and deeper, and it is becoming a permanent feature of the 21st century's geopolitical landscape.
And what are the terms of the treaty? What does it accomplish?
Well, it actually touches on a lot of different areas, quite a lot about economic cooperation, quite a lot in there about diplomatic cooperation as well. But the most interesting and the most important aspect of this treaty is what it says about Russia and China's military support for each other. Article 9 of the treaty states, "When a situation arises in which one of the contracting parties deems that peace is being threatened and undermined, or its security interests are involved, or when it is confronted with the threat of aggression, the contracting parties shall immediately hold contacts and consultations in order to eliminate such threats." End quote. So this means if one of the two comes under attack, the other would be obligated to defend it. You know, it's not binding quite to the degree that Article 5 in the NATO Charter is. The Russia-China Treaty stops short of a full military alliance, but it does provide a foundation on which a full military alliance could easily and very quickly be built. So that's, by far the most important aspect of this treaty. And I think it's very significant that in the 20 years since this treaty was originally signed, Russia and China have held no fewer than 30 sets of joint military drills. That's at a pace of about one every 18 months. So these are war games where they're practicing fighting adversaries shoulder to shoulder with each other. And these kind of exercises give personnel from one nation's forces all kinds of insight into what is normally very, very secretive aspects of the other side's, you know, command and control, technological know-how, and all kinds of other aspects of their military machines. So it's clear from those drills that Russia and China are acting on the treaty. And the frequency of them, I think, speaks to a truly rare level of trust and reliance between these two Asian giants.
We've talked about just how historically significant it is that these two nations have found a way to work together. I think what's interesting is if you look at the world today and you look at the leaders of the great nations today, Russia and China are really two of the perhaps the greatest two examples of the rise in authoritarianism that we see among nations today. And these two leaders have done a lot to cement their power, to extend their power, to increase the level of authoritarianism within their nations. The fact that they're working together the way that they are is significant in that their view of governance seems to be very much aligned with one another, and they're very comfortable in working together. And this week there was even more evidence of just them doing exactly that, extending their power over their nations.
Yes, that's right. These two, as you said, they've really become kind of the poster men for the modern return to authoritarianism. And this week, both of them, it was really more of just kind of this provocative language that we're increasingly hearing from them about anyone who dares to threaten their power from other nations. But just 2 days after the treaty was extended, Vladimir Putin made a television appearance, and he really went out of his way to challenge U.S. leadership in world affairs. He said the era of U.S. dominance is over. He boasted that Russia has, quote, surpassed the European countries and even the U.S. in some key military capabilities. We'll get into a specific one of those in the second half. But then he said, if any nation crosses certain red lines with Russia, Russia will, quote, find asymmetrical ways to respond. So pretty brazen there. And then the very next day, Xi Jinping spoke in Tiananmen Square in Beijing. This was to mark the 100-year anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party's founding. And he ended up speaking for about an hour. He spent most of that time just praising the system of, you know, Marxism with Chinese characteristics that modern China is built on. But then at one point, he made some highly explosive remarks about any nation that tries to challenge China. He said, quote, the Chinese people will never allow any outside forces to bully, oppress, or enslave us. Anyone who tries to do so will be crushed to death before the Great Wall of Steel built with the flesh and blood of over 1.4 billion Chinese people. So just some, you know, incendiary statements there.
And coming from him, that you have to realize this is not bluster.
No, not at all.
He actually will back that up.
He will. And you may remember from the show a couple of weeks ago that Xi Jinping had just issued the officials in his government to start to build a more lovable and gentle image for China. And then yesterday he goes out of his way, you know, publicly to say China will crush to death anyone who kind of stands in our way.
The PR department probably threw a hissy fit after that.
I would hope so. And this happened in Tiananmen Square. He's talking about crushing people to death in this very square where the government did crush thousands of their own people to death 30 years ago, people who wanted the country to become more democratic. So just kind of a little bit of tragic irony there. But I don't think it's going to help that image that he wants to foster of lovability at all.
So you have these two authoritarians over these two Asian giant nations. They're pledging greater and greater cooperation and backing that up with military exercises, all kinds of economic agreements. If you're a student of Bible prophecy, if you followed the prophecies that Herbert W. Armstrong drew attention to for decades, this is exactly what we would expect.
It is. Yes, it's happening exactly as Mr. Armstrong forecast so many years ago that it would. And that's really why we spend so much time at the trumpet, just very carefully watching Russia-China ties come together. Because, you know, Bible prophecy does talk about what you mentioned at the beginning there, the kings of the East. This is a multinational Asian power bloc that will form in the modern era. The scriptures show that it'll end up playing a major role in the third and final world war. And so when we see Russia and China coming together and cooperating in all these ways, it's really paving the way for that Kings of the East bloc to come together.
Well, Jeremiah has written an article, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping Extend Landmark China-Russia Cooperation Treaty. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. And we will also link to an article that Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, wrote on this very subject, Asia Stands with Putin, and just showing how much support there is within Asia for the rule of Russia's strongman. We will link to both of those in the show notes, and we thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Palestinian politics could be in for a big change. Public opinion has turned decidedly against the current leadership, and the reasons for this may be deeper than they first appear. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
For the past, I believe it's been a month now, there's been a very hard crackdown on journalists inside the West Bank that are reporting on the rule of Mahmoud Abbas, the longtime president of the Palestinian Authority that rules also over the Fatah faction. That group rules over the West Bank, and Hamas, of course, is over the Gaza Strip. And yet there is growing dissatisfaction with him. He's been there. I think he's meant to have reigned or ruled for just 4 years. But now this is his 18th year, I believe, or close to it, of his reign. And he is a dictator by all in all intensive purposes of that word. He looks after the kitty of international funds that are given to the PLO or to the Palestinian Authority, directs them at will. He's aging. I think he's almost 80 or around that age. And so a lot of people are very fed up in Palestinian society. And there was a poll from June 12th to June 14th that showed that 53% of Palestinians believe that Hamas is the most deserving of representing and leading the Palestinian people. And only 14% prefer Abbas's more secular Fatah party. So he's really unpopular right now. And it's been going that way for the past couple of years, but now he's extremely unpopular. And yet what's interesting is that he is making himself even more unpopular by cracking down on journalists. On June 24th, his henchmen actually went out and murdered an activist that is very popular on Facebook, Palestinian activist, that has spoken out against Abbas's rule. And this is something you might not have heard about. He doesn't have the appeal of Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered by the Saudis. Everyone knows his name. But this is something that has happened very similar, except that this wasn't at the hand of the Saudis. This was at the hand of Mahmoud Abbas. Now, the interesting element to this is that the intriguing element is that why would Mahmoud Abbas start rounding up a journalist against his that are speaking out against his rule at this time? And we have a really informative Palestinian journalist, Caleb Abu Tome. He's been writing on Palestinian affairs for the Jerusalem Post and Gladstone Institute for about 20 years. He's very well regarded. And he put out a piece earlier this week, last week, that talked about how that Abbas actually received, most likely received, a green light from the Biden administration to authorize this crackdown on the journalists. Not necessarily saying go out and do that, but by saying that, well, we're still going to give you all the funding that you want. We are not going to penalize you for doing that. And Abbas has really taken that and ran with it. And what Toomer is writing is that the United States is most likely doing this because it knows that with this green light, that Abbas is going to take the bait and he's going to become even more unpopular, and that protests are going to come out on the street of Ramallah, of Hebron, and which they are doing, to in effect make Hamas even more popular, make the Islamists even more popular than they were even going back a month or two ago. And so that's what we see happening right now on the Palestinian street through the West Bank. Huge protests against the rule of Mahmoud Abbas that are spurred on, at least according to this Palestinian journalist, world-famous, award-winning Palestinian journalist, egged on by the United States policy.
This is a pretty explosive charge. I think if anyone is just coming into this story fresh and hearing you talk about the idea that the Biden administration is actually more interested in a radical Hamas ruling the Palestinians than the poison that you know, Mahmoud Abbas, they would say, well, show me more evidence, because this is kind of an indirect set of dots that you're connecting here. But help us to understand the bigger picture with respect to the Biden administration's Palestinian policy.
Right. And I think by comparing it to what happened in Egypt in 2011 and 2012 is very important It's very instructive in what's going on right now. And I think it's an almost perfect parallel. Back then, you had the Arab Spring that started in Tunisia and spread across North Africa, which was basically the calling for the removal of longtime dictators and not even a return, but a time of democratic rule along these North African states. And it affected Libya with Gaddafi's fall, with the U.S. backing. It also affected Tunisia. And it affected most of all what took place in Egypt. And that is where the parallel lies, because you had a strong man in power that was a dictator, Hosni Mubarak, but an American ally. And yes, he did clamp down on freedoms of the press. He didn't rule in a democratic way. However, Mubarak and even the United States policymakers understood that he was better than the alternative, which is the rise of the Islamist parties. And that in Egypt, meaning the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so what even our Mr. Gerald Flory had even called for or even noted at the time that President Barack Obama was leading this outreach to the Muslim world started with his famous Cairo speech in 2009 with this outstretched hand of democracy from the United States to these Arab states. He said that this is going to end up with Mubarak looking from the outside in and with a likely rulership of the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamist Party. And so eventually Barack Obama did call for that as protests took to the streets of the Arab Spring. Barack Obama called for the removal of the dictator that the United States knew, knowing full well that the Muslim Brotherhood would gain victory in democratic elections soon thereafter. And that's exactly what happened, because Barack Obama believed in the legitimacy of Islamist parties ruling over Islamist nations. And what we have in the West Bank is a very popular Hamas. Hamas, of course, is a daughter of the Muslim Brotherhood movement coming out of that movement in 1989. And you have chief, really critical policymakers for the United States in Israel right now that are very pro-Hamas or pro-Muslim Brotherhood. We've talked about Hadi Amir. He is a former director of the Doha Center of the Brookings Institute in Qatar. And Qatar is the chief sponsor of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and has been funding, as well as Iran, Hamas for a long, long time. And he has even talked about how Hamas needs to join the negotiating table in the past. He is going to be your Palestinian consular general. The Biden administration wants to open up a consulate for the state of Palestine in Jerusalem. Highly illegal according to U.S. law, but it looks like it's going to go ahead. And the figure that's going to lead them is somebody that would rather Hamas in power. And then you have the Biden pick, Tom Nides. He is the pick for the ambassador to the state of Israel. He's another Obamaphile. He was back in the State Department as deputy secretary of state from 2011 to 2013. And what's interesting about him is what did he do? He was very, very instrumental in bringing the Muslim Brotherhood firmly into power after the election. He led 100 business delegates to Cairo soon after the election of the Muslim Brotherhood to try and make sure that American business contracts were made with the Muslim Brotherhood to solidify their rule on power. That is what former Israeli ambassador Michael Oren wrote in his book Ally. And he is going to be Biden's ambassador to the state of Israel. So both the ambassador, if you can call it that, to the figurative state of Palestine that doesn't exist, and both the ambassador to the state of Israel, soon coming if he's confirmed by the Senate, both of them have a history of bringing Islamists in from the cold during the Obama administration. And here they are again, at the same time as you see Hamas rising in power and the dictator of the Palestinians this time, Mahmoud Abbas, shrinking in his popular power.
You mentioned the situation in Egypt, really understanding the popular public opinion there. You know that to encourage democracy is going to empower the radical elements there. This trend that we see developing within the Palestinian population, where even after this latest skirmish with Israel made Hamas all the more popular, and that really they've been growing in popularity to some degree or another for some time, to the point where if you say democracy, let the people speak in Palestine, Hamas wins hands down. It's pretty interesting to see just how much public support this radical terrorist group has gained.
Yeah, so much so that I went to a press briefing this week of a Palestinian professor at Al-Quds University, and he doesn't like Abbas. He hates him. He wants him to be gone. But he said, we can't take him out right now. We can't take him out right now because Hamas is going to take over, and nobody, well, at least those that are thinking, don't really want that to happen as well. But it really does speak to what we're seeing, as you said, this growth in power of Hamas in the West Bank. This is something that we have expected to happen based on a prophecy in Zechariah chapter 14 that Mr. Flory goes into in his Zechariah booklet, which explains that there is going to be a hostile takeover by the Palestinians of East Jerusalem. They are going to violently attempt to do that. Right now, Abbas is in direct security, a direct security partnership with the State of Israel. That's not going to happen. That takeover is not going to happen under his rule. And so we've expected a Hamas growth in power. And I think the way that it comes about, we'll see. This is a little bit speculative this way, but the bottom line is, as I've described, but the bottom line is we are seeing massive swelling of support for Hamas among the Palestinians.
Well, this was the subject of our trumpet brief on Wednesday. Brent wrote an article, "Is the United States Preparing to Topple Mahmoud Abbas?" And you can read that at thetrumpet.com. We'll link to it in the show notes. But you can also subscribe to the daily Trumpet Brief email alert that comes free to your inbox by just visiting the front page of thetrumpet.com. We'd be happy to send that to you and add you to our subscriber list. Thank you very much for that, Brent. After recent stabbings in Germany and Austria, the governments of these countries took quite different approaches in their responses. And it highlights a problem that many Germans are deeply frustrated by. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, almost as we were recording the program this time last week, an immigrant from Somalia was shouting Allahu Akbar and trying to stab people in downtown Würzburg in Germany. He killed three women, injured six others, a disturbing attack. I was going to say shocking, but these kind of things have become frequent enough that they probably shouldn't surprise us anymore.
Right.
But another violent attack in Germany from a recent migrant. Like you said, though, that's an interesting contrast with another attack that we saw a little bit later in Austria. So in June 29th, Austrian police arrested two Afghan men after the body of a 13-year-old girl had been found in Donaustadt, and they were suspected of abusing and killing the girl. But you know, in Germany, there was this was pretty clear-cut in terms of it being a terrorist attack. I think it doesn't get much more clear-cut than that. You've got a Muslim man, an immigrant from a Muslim-majority country. He's shouting Allahu Akbar, and then going and stabbing people. You know, it's a terrorist attack. But there was a great deal of reluctance within Germany to label that. It took quite a long time for them it took 2 days for the Bavarian interior minister to say there are some indications here that it could be Islamist terror. But of course, it all has to be carefully investigated. And the premier, Markus Söder, of that same state, Bavaria, this federal state of Germany where the attack took place, he said the attacker should not be labeled, quote, someone with a migrant background. There's a refusal to talk about or engage with this, which was, it was quite strikingly different from how the Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, forcefully dealt with this attack in Austria. This was an attack on a 13-year-old girl. Quite understandably, there was a lot of outrage at this attack. And he tweeted, "The cruel act that has been committed in Vienna makes me deeply concerned and angry. It is unacceptable that people come to our country, state they're looking for protection, and then commit cruel crimes. My deepest sympathy goes to the family of the girl." Just a much more forceful response. In Germany, the response from a lot of the leaders was kind of more around defending the attacker and trying to avoid wider concerns of stigma and things like that, whereas Sebastian Kurz was much more expressing sympathy and solidarity with the victim.
Talk about the public response to these disparate responses by the governments.
Well, Kurz, first of all, he has his whole, or pretty much the fact that he is the Chancellor of Austria is built on this kind of harder response. The fact that he was very public, even before he was Chancellor, in trying to close down migrants coming into Austria, saying we've got to address this problem and we can't let this be a taboo, and that he has taken this tough stance, and it's made him pretty much the most popular politician in Austria. And he's been embroiled in scandals recently. I could only think that something like this would boost his popularity. Meanwhile, in Germany, something that I can point to in terms of a survey that's been done right after this attack, but there is nobody with Kurz's popularity within Germany. We've talked for quite a bit about the election that's coming up and the way that there is no clear leader, and there's nobody that people really have much enthusiasm behind. And when you see these different responses, you can start to get a picture of why people do want somebody who will deal with the problem. And this is something we had an article a few years ago, Germany Migrants and Angela Merkel's Big Lie by Trumpet.com managing editor Brad McDonald. And what he talked about here is, to a certain extent, the leaders in Germany, the people that don't want to talk about the migrant background, are well-intentioned. They don't want to stir up divisions and things like that. And sure, maybe they're concerned about Muslims being unfairly stigmatized and that kind of thing. But by refusing to engage with the problem, they are making it much worse. You can see in Austria the way that people do want somebody who's actually going to deal with the problem. In Germany, because all of the mainstream politicians refuse to deal with the problem, what's happened is you've had this surge in support for much more extreme voices, voices that would never play a major role in German politics without it. That you've got some of these neo-Nazi type groups and the Alternative for Deutschland, which there are some people within that party that have some very concerning views and that talk about how they need to be proud of what their soldiers accomplished during World War I and World War II, that kind of rhetoric. And that party is soaring in popularity and people express relief now when they only get 20% of the vote or 18% of the vote. It used to be huge news when they got 2% of the vote. And that's directly because the mainstream politicians won't engage with it. And so it's pushing people to the only people that will, which is these extreme voices.
Well, I think it's quite stunning, given the fact that this has been a trend developing over many years now, that you still have German politicians, prominently placed politicians, who are still so unwilling to state the obvious. That the average German citizen who sees an incident like what took place this past week, it's just screaming obvious that what the problem is, and the politicians are just refusing to depart from their very measured, calculated response. You would think that by now that more of them would be on board with the general sentiment when it comes to these types of incidents.
Yeah, that surprised me. I thought people were starting to wake up to this, politicians, right, and the effect. I mean, they've been talking about this. The effect is pretty obvious. It doesn't take much to look hard. It doesn't take a long, hard look at Germany to see the rise of the far right there. And people have been talking about the cause why and identifying it. Yet still they won't do that. And it is something that is very dangerous. And Angela Merkel has taken the lead on this, and so many of the people even at the top of the right-wing parties are exactly in that mold. In that article, Mr. McDonald talked about how if Angela Merkel continues to do this, Germany's chancellor risks transforming the German people and Germany itself into something very different and much more frightening than the democratic, peaceful, friendly nation Germany is today. Angela Merkel is turning the German people into a ticking time bomb, he wrote. And this is exactly
five and a half years ago. 5.5 years ago.
Yes. And they're still doing it. And I think the foot has come off the gas pedal in some ways on the migrant crisis since then. You know, you had millions pouring across the borders 5.5 years ago. That has slowed, but there's the potential for that to increase again at just a moment's notice with all the instability in the Middle East. And there's nervousness about that all the time and what that would do to further political disruption. But the Bible talks about a radical change coming to Germany. And it talks about a new kind of leader coming to Germany. There are prophecies in Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11 that written thousands of years ago that talk about, you know, the book of Daniel over and over again. It says it's for the end time. It's for the end time. And there are historical fulfillments of some of these prophecies, but the book makes clear that the main purpose of these is end time prophecies. Mm. They're for a time far in the future from when Daniel was writing. And we are in the stages of seeing those prophecies fulfilled. It talks about a leader with a fierce countenance coming, you know, a change in how Germany is run. We see a change away, you know, the Germany that we see right now that, you know, looks like a Western peaceful democracy. Well, what Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel 11 describe is a very different Germany. Mm-hmm. So we know that there is a big change coming. And other scriptures give us much more texture and detail about that change. And so, you know, that forecast that Mr. MacDonald wrote 5.5 years ago fundamentally is based on that Bible prophecy. And, you know, you can very easily see that continuing to be fulfilled. And we've got a booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, that will go into much more details in those prophecies as well and show you just how this fits into God's plan for end time events and what he forecast thousands of years ago.
Well, we thank you very much for that, Richard. We do have, in addition to that booklet and the article by Brad MacDonald, Germany, Migrants, and Angela Merkel's Big Lie, we have two articles by Josue Michels on the website right now, one about the German incident, Germany mourns latest victims of terrorism, and one about the Austrian incident, a tragic death, a tough response from Austria. Thank you very much again, Richard. We go now to America's southern border, where immigrants are streaming in illegally in record numbers. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
It's been 14 weeks since Joe Biden put Kamala Harris in charge of the border crisis. And in those 14 weeks, more than 500,000 illegal immigrants have crossed into the southern United States. That means that for the first time since Bill Clinton was president, border agents are actually stopping about 6,000 immigrants each and every day. So these are two-decade highs and definitely shaping up to be one of the biggest scandals of the Biden-Harris administration. Public opinion polls show that only about 1 in 4 American adults approves of the way Biden is handling the border crisis. And so when you break that down, that means pretty much all the Republicans and half the Democrats don't like those open door policies that we're seeing today. So a number of analysts have pointed out that this really could be this is really undermining confidence in the Biden administration. And seeing his opening to draw attention to how much worse things have gotten in the past few months, President Donald Trump visited the border this week. On Wednesday, he went down there along with the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, to visit the border. They actually were like 31 members of Congress went with him. So, I mean, that's a pretty significant chunk of Congress who didn't took a sick day and showed up in Texas as well.
I figured with the former president.
Right, with the former president. Figures like whatever he's talking about the border is probably what's more important than whatever was happening in Congress that day anyway. and went down there. And, yeah, President Trump, he had a roundtable meeting with Governor Abbott and some other officials before he held his rally, where he really noted that he said, we have a sick country in many ways. It's sick in its elections and it's sick in its border. If you don't have good elections and you don't have a strong border, you don't have a country. And so that's some pretty sound logic there. You'd think that just like what's the basic definition of a country or a basic definition of a democracy means that the people who live there have borders so that people who don't live there can't just come in and vote in our elections. But after that roundtable meeting, he did hold a rally where he really pointed out, he's this kind of funny the way he phrased this. He said, all Biden had to do was go to the beach. If he'd just done nothing, we would now have the strongest border we had ever had. And then he pointed out that when he took over as president, they were having problems is that we'd catch like criminal illegal immigrants from MS-16 and other gangs and terrorist groups, and then we'd try to deport them. And the countries they came from, in Guatemala and El Salvador and Nicaragua, they wouldn't take them back. And Trump was asking, he says, well, why can't we just deport these people? He's like, well, their countries won't accept them. And he's like, well, do we give them money? He's like, well, yeah, we give them a lot of money. And he's like, well, threaten to stop giving them money and they'll probably take them back. And and behold, that worked. And then when rumors spread throughout all every tavern in old Mexico that you get deported if you go to the United States, people stopped coming to the United States.
This isn't rocket science.
Right. And so Trump made the point that he's like, yeah, it's like if Biden would have went to the beach and not changed any of that, we'd be in a pretty good situation right now. But instead, he came in and like day one ordered a halt on the building of the border wall and then had his officials let the Central Americans know that we'll give you aid. We love you no matter what, and we'll give you aid whether you take your MS-13 gang members back or not. And so they decided, like, well, if that's the case, we'll let you keep the gang members because we don't want them. And we have this crisis today.
It seems like the contrast between Donald Trump and Joe Biden is nowhere more stark than on this border issue. The fact that we have an administration right now that is so bent on opening those borders and creating this crisis really does point to some pretty serious problems and major prophecies regarding end time America.
Right. We have an article that we can put in the show notes. It's also in our last print edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet. It's from our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, entitled Joe Biden's Border Catastrophe, that delves a little deeper into some of the specific policy changes that the Biden administration made from what the Trump administration was doing that's created these crises. But then it also highlights a number of prophecies in the Bible that talks about prophecies in Deuteronomy that talks about the stranger within your gates getting up very high and you coming down very low. There's also prophecies in like Isaiah 1 that talks about the stranger or some translations of the Bible even say the alien in your cities, burning them in with riots and with fire and with crime and other problems like that. There's even another article that we're probably have going up on the Trumpet soon that I'd wrote about Donald Trump's visit to the border crisis in particular. That even talks about like a prophecy in Hosea, specifically Hosea 7 through 8 through 9, that talks about foreigners eating away Israel's strength in the end time and sapping that away, making the whole country almost like a cake unturned or a moth-eaten coat. And so there's just numerous scriptures about just the damage that can be done to a nation, end time Israel in particular, when you've got just these unvetted foreigners coming in and the government doesn't know who they are and doing whatever type of illegal or fraudulent activities they want.
Well, Andrew has an article that will appear on thetrumpet.com very soon. Donald Trump visits U.S.-Mexico border. You can watch for that. And also Joe Biden's border catastrophe in the latest print edition of The Trumpet magazine. Thanks so much, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about Russia's hypersonic missiles, America just days from completing its withdrawal from Afghanistan, and more. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In the development of modern weapons, one of the most revolutionary technologies is hypersonic missiles. To learn about Russia's latest developments on this front, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia has just demonstrated that it truly is leading the pack in the development of hypersonic weapons. This was with some of Russia's MiG-31K interceptor jets. They were conducting drills this week in the eastern Mediterranean, and the drills centered around the Kinzhal hypersonic missiles. And for the first time, these interceptor jets were equipped with them during war games. So Russia has had hypersonic missiles for a few years now, but there's always a considerable delay in coordinating the various systems together, you know, getting the jets customized so that they can carry and launch whatever the new weaponry is. So this is a big milestone that Russia has crossed here, having not just coordinated those systems, but now having actually conducted flight tests with them during exercises. And so it does put Russia far ahead of the U.S. or any other nation that's working to develop hypersonic weapons. You know, America and the others are nowhere near the point of actually conducting war games with them. So Russia's really been leading the pack with hypersonics from the beginning. And with this week's drills in the Mediterranean, they've shown that they remain very much in the lead of this hypersonic arms race.
Why is this so important prophetically? What has the Trumpet said about this in the past?
Well, the U.S. is not able to stop these kinds of missiles with even our most advanced defense systems, and the same is true for Europe. And really, from a prophetic standpoint, it's Europe that we need to be watching here for a response to Russia's increasing aggression and its strides in developing these kinds of unstoppable weapons. This is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has addressed several times. One of those was in an article that he wrote just after Russia had annexed Crimea. At that time, he said, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy." So, you know, the Europeans certainly have not forgotten what Russia did with Ukraine there, especially since aspects of that conflict are ongoing. And the Europeans see Putin's unstoppable hypersonic weapons. I think the fact that these drills happened in the Mediterranean, you know, right there in Europe's backyard, that would not have been lost on the Europeans. So we can be sure that the fear of Russia that is now growing stronger among Europeans is deepening their desire to unify Europe politically and militarily, because they understand that within a unified European bloc, they'd be much better able to stand up to this rising Russian threat.
I'm glad you brought that point out, because just thinking back to our discussion in the first half, as you were talking about the rise of Russia and China, I was thinking, really, Europe is watching this. Europe is very aware of what's happening in Asia, and you're absolutely right. The response of Russia to what's happening in Asia, not just regarding hypersonic missiles, but everything that's taking place over there, really is one of the most prophetically significant aspects of what's happening here. We will link to an article on thetrumpet.com, Russia's Unstoppable Hypersonic Missiles, if you want more information about this. And we thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Now to Afghanistan, where America is just days away from completing its withdrawal. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is actually ahead of schedule. We know that President Biden has said that he wanted to bring the troops home by September 11th, and yet there's lots of reports coming out that all American forces could be completely withdrawn from Afghanistan in the coming days. And this is something that is reported all over the world. It follows a statement that was released by a United States general who's overseeing this, General Scott Miller. He gave a briefing on Tuesday saying that, painting a very dark picture, that as the United States withdraws, morale is slipping among the Afghani forces that have fought alongside the United States. And in the past month, the insurgents led by the Taliban, of course, whom Taliban was one of the main players that the United States sought to eradicate from leadership in Afghanistan, they've taken over more than 50 of the 37 districts in the past month. So as the United States withdraws and announced its withdrawal, You've got Afghani forces that are trying to hold on to gains that the U.S. forces have helped with, but they are losing in the rural areas. And even the Taliban is starting to knock on the doors of Kabul, the capital. And so this is a very dangerous situation. The editorial board of the Wall Street Journal actually put out a piece on June 29th about it. They said this is the first two paragraphs. Americans of a certain age will recall the humiliating U.S. flight from Saigon as the North Vietnamese Army marched into the city in 1975. The desperate pleas of the Vietnamese at the U.S. Embassy gates, the last helicopters taking off from the embassy roof. Could we soon see the same in Afghanistan? On the current pace of events, we might, as the U.S. continues to withdraw its troops ahead of President Biden's September 11th deadline. The Taliban is rapidly advancing around the country, and NBC Dispatch Tuesday said their gains have been so rapid that even the jihadists are surprised. Some Taliban are actually slowing their march to make sure they don't give the Americans second thoughts, meaning that they are just... It's like a very fast troop movement across the country, sweeping into these districts that the U.S. are leaving. And will we see something very soon similar to what was seen at the end of the Vietnam War, where the U.S. leaving and you have the Afghanis, like the Vietnamese, are saying, now what? Now what do we do? The general on Tuesday said that it's hard to foresee anything but civil war taking place in Afghanistan after the United States withdrawal.
It's stunning to see this take place, and yet it's something that we've been expecting, we've been talking about, we've been anticipating for really over a decade now.
Yeah, almost two decades. If you go back to our November 2001 Trumpet magazine, we boldly stated back then that the United States won't be victors in this war. And base that on the prophecy in Leviticus 26, verse 19, that says that God is going to break the pride of the power of end-time Israelites, of which America forms a major part of those nations. And because of that, with the other verse that it talks about there in verse 20, it also says that America's or Israel's strength shall be spent in vain. And based on that prophecy and also the understanding of Mr. Armstrong, the forerunner of the Trumpet magazine and the Plain Truth, called almost, I guess it's about 50 years ago now, that right. America had won its last war, that we knew that the United States was not going to be victorious, that its strength was going to be spent in vain. 2,300 Americans have died in the Afghani war against the Taliban. Over $1 trillion has been spent by the United States on this war. And the United States is going to be pulling out and leaving it in a worse state than when the United States entered in 2001. And what it looks like civil war will erupt. But then you also have these other powers like China that are trying to get involved. But we'll see. There's a lot of things at play here with Afghanistan. It's kind of a really important nation geopolitically. But I think the angle that's most important to note, given that America might be pulling out this week, is that this is something that the Trumpet said was going to happen the very months that U.S. forces were entering the country.
Yeah, the evoking the history of the Vietnam War is very interesting. And you talk about what Herbert W. Armstrong said decades ago about World War II being the last victorious war that America waged, and the ignominy, the trouble that the United States suffered in the Vietnam War, and just what a stark picture that was of a nation with a broken will that was cursed, that was unable to bring this little Asian nation to heel. Really, we haven't seen anything on quite the same scale since then, because these wars have been so protracted. But here, when it comes to the final days of this conflict that has dragged on for two decades in Afghanistan, to see similar scenes taking place, or what we could very well see within these last days, is really very evocative of those prophecies that Mr. Armstrong was pointing to. If people want more information about this specifically, and maybe looking at what the Trumpet has been saying, what do you think is the best place for them to find that, Brent?
Well, we have been reporting on this for a while, but I wonder if we can even leave a link to the November 2001 trumpet, which goes into the war on terror and the fight in Afghanistan, and just look back at our very accurate forecast of what we said was going to happen.
All right, we will do that. Thank you very much for that, Brent. In a major post-Brexit agreement, Britain and Germany signed a defense declaration this week. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, they agreed a 20-point declaration outlining how the two are going to work together after Brexit when it comes to defense. And they want to work together pretty closely. That's the general consensus. Angela Merkel is actually visiting the UK today, where there's quite a number of things other than just defense on the table, but they were hammering this out ahead of the visit. Some of the big standouts to me is there was a commitment to the strategic unity of Europe. So even though Britain has left the European Union now, we're still saying, well, we commit to a united Europe and we're not going to try to break Europe up. The other one that I thought was pretty remarkable was that Britain said that we would support Germany's ambition to have a permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council, which, you know, that's remarkable. That's the five leading nations of the world, in theory. With Germany on there, it would be six. So that's really supporting Germany to have a very high level of power and influence in the world. And to have somebody that has already got a seat on the Permanent Security Council to then be backing that, and I think France may well be backing that as well, that's a pretty big boost for Germany. So Britain really saying, well, despite Brexit, we do still want to be very close friends with Germany. And this is fascinating because it conforms to really all of the details of Bible prophecy. We were saying for years and years and years, Brexit's going to happen. There's going to be this European superpower. Britain is not going to be part of it. They're going to leave. And that is based on some very clear prophecies. At the same time, though, there's another set of prophecies that talk about Britain relying on Europe, Britain relying especially upon Germany, looking to Germany for its defense. So you put those together and you'd be expecting Brexit, mm-hmm. but Britain to still look and rely upon Germany. And that is exactly what we're seeing in the post-Brexit relationship now, with these kind of declarations being signed. And there's further declarations they want to sign with France and with Italy. So still looking to Europe. And we have a Trumpet editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, had an article in 2014, The Significance of Germany's Break from America. As you can tell from the title, that is focused on America. But that is a great place to go to get more detail about those prophecies, where exactly in the Bible it talks about Britain and America, both of these countries really looking to and relying on Germany for their security.
That is quite stunning. And if you wouldn't mind just commenting briefly, what strikes me is the fact that that Britain is advocating for Germany's place on the Security Council individually as a nation, considering all the efforts at European unification and Europe speaking with one voice, having Germany basically singled out in that way seems particularly interesting.
That is an interesting point, that they're not the European Union itself has long wanted a seat on the European Security Council, and it is interesting to see Germany push for not a European Union seat, our seat.
Right.
And I think it does show you the way that Germany uses the European Union as a vehicle for its own ambitions, rather than being a true believer in the European Union cause.
Yeah. Well, we do appreciate that. Richard, one final story on today's program. Just how radical is the administration of Joe Biden? We'll take a look at the people he's putting in charge of the Department of the Interior. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's definitely no shortage of radical people in the Biden administration. If you look at their policies or even just do a little bit of digging, I mean, there's several members who have some disturbingly few links between them and members of the Communist Party USA. But if you thought that it couldn't get more radical, you may be wrong. The Senate is currently considering a new head for the department, for the Bureau of Land Management. That would be Tracy Stone Manning, who she would be, if confirmed, she would be managing America's public lands, public grasslands, public forests, national parks. even though she's actually a convicted eco-terrorist from a tree spiking incident in 1989. According to their Senate confirmation hearing, she was part of the eco-terrorist group Earth First back when she was a graduate student and worked for their publication. And knew of a plot to spike, take 500 pounds of tree spikes and spike some trees in Utah. And then for tree spiking, you know, you put the spike in the tree. That way, if a logger tries to cut it down, the chainsaw will hit the spike and then ricochet. And I mean, sometimes it even rips off part of your face. So definitely a terrorist act. I guess there wasn't actually any proof yet that she was wielding the hammer, but she definitely knew about it and wrote the letter that they sent to the Forest Service to let them know that you can't cut down these trees because we've spiked them. And yet, despite that confirmation hearing is going forward, it seems pretty likely that this former eco-terrorist may soon be running the department she once tried to commit an act of terrorism against, but I'm sure we'll have more information on that in the weeks ahead.
I wish we could talk more about this. We're about out of time, but I would encourage you to look at an article that Andrew Miller has slated to go up on thetrumpet.com very soon, if not today. Meet the Environmental Radicals Taking Over the Department of the Interior. And it'll give you more information about this really fascinating story. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much to these gentlemen, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Thomas Edison. When you have exhausted all possibilities, remember this, you haven't. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.